Hi, and welcome to the Cancer Horizons podcast. Each week, we talk with patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, or healthcare professionals and do what CURE does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. Before her son was diagnosed with leukemia, Janice Postwhite's career as a cancer nurse was much more straightforward, but after enduring the emotional journey of navigating her son's cancer treatments, her research interests and passions shifted. In this episode of the Cancer Horizons podcast, Postwhite provides insight on what it was like to approach her son's cancer through a unique lens and how it led her to writing a book about the journey titled Standing at Water's Edge.
All right, so just to kind of jump right in, for those who are unfamiliar with your book, could you introduce yourself and provide a little bit of an overview of the story behind it?
Sure. I was an oncology nurse for 15 years before Brennan was diagnosed, but I was predominantly working in adult oncology. I did some pediatrics. I taught some students in Chicago at Children's Hospital, and then in University of Minnesota. But my background has predominantly been adult. However, then I had a couple of students in Peds Onc at Minnesota. And I remember saying to one student, you know, I really need to know more about pediatric oncology. And that year my son was diagnosed. I guess you'd be careful what you wish for. But what I also learned is I had a PhD in nursing, and I had a background, a minor in immunology pathobiology, because I was interested in psychoneuroimmunology, or how the mind and the body communicate. So all of my research focused in that area, but none of what I did prepared me to be a cancer mom. I did immune assays in the lab and studied imagery and massage and mindfulness meditation and healing touch therapies, and everything I knew about cancer, I thought I knew what it was, but it was when my son was diagnosed that I learned I really don't know how to be a mom. And there's a lot more than just knowing and the knowledge. It's really the emotional realm. And what I guess I learned is that emotions hide, but they don't disappear. And so that's why I wrote the book.
Wonderful. Thank you.
So with CURE, not only do we focus on patient-related voices, but also caregivers as well. So how did you, as a nurse, balance being a nurse, being a parent, being a caregiver, especially for such a young child?
I don't think I balanced it very well.
And did you fake it till you make it? How about that?
You know, you learn a lot going through something. And I think, you know, it's sitting back and reflecting on what did I learn and what would I have done differently that helps prepare you for the next event. And the one thing I do know is I learned to say no, which was a big step. And it's a big step for a lot of women who have careers and young children, and how to balance all of that. And so what I did is I learned through one experience that's written in my book, is in the book Standing at Water's Edge, is how to take why I learned to take 24 hours to reply to someone because I jumped in too soon. So now when someone asks me to do something, whether it's speak or travel or to take on any new project, I ask, can I do it? Do I want to do it? And is it important to me to do it? And so sitting back and reflecting on that and giving myself 24 hours allowed me to say no. So that's one thing I learned. And one example is I was asked to do a talk in Washington, D.C. on my son's 8th birthday. And I said, no, I can't travel. I need to be home for my son. And so they really wanted me there, apparently, because they found out that Brennan had done a couple of talks with me on stage, one of them for APON with an opening ceremonies keynote in Phoenix. And so they found out he had been on stage before. And so they invited him. So we did a parent family panel on stage in Washington, D.C. on his birthday. And he talked too, in his 8-minute speech, he stands up and says, and, you know, when I was 4 years old, I was diagnosed with leukemia. And today I'm 8 years old and it's my birthday. And the entire audience of 1,500 people just stood up and sang happy birthday to him. And so that was the moment when I realized that my roles came together. that I was a respected colleague on stage. I was an incredibly proud parent, and I was a relieved and appreciative caregiver to be there at that moment in time. And we don't always find that kind of balance in our roles. I think sometimes it's just a matter of getting through and doing what you need to do. And I talk about that in my book because I was a tenure track faculty member. I worked weekends. I taught school in the evenings. I managed a household with a 1 and a 4-year-old, and my husband traveled every week for work. Yeah, we had help, but it really, the burden is really on the family unit, and somebody has to be responsible. You can delegate, but you can only do so much. So I guess I was always on call. And in the middle of it, my father was diagnosed with lung cancer. So, you know, you're always on call. You do what you need to do. And oftentimes you just get through it. Another parent told me, we're like oxen. My husband and I are like two oxen tethered to a cart, pulling it along through the muck, you know, and you just do what you need to do. And I reflected on that and thought, you know what? I think that's the way for all families. I don't know how single parents do it at all, you know, without having a tribe of support. You know, you don't have somebody next to you, you know, helping you to take turns, which is what my husband and I did, is, you know, it's your turn.
So how did you handle the guilt that you potentially felt of telling people, no, maybe you couldn't do this because you had to put your family first?
You know, I think the guilt comes from within. We lay the guilt on ourselves. And so I think for me to step back and say, it's not the events that are so important, it's how we respond to them. And if we're going to respond with guilt, it's up to us to learn to let it go. So it took me a long time, though. It took me writing this book to let it go. You know, I was with my father 24 hours before he was diagnosed with a massive heart attack, and I didn't see the symptoms. I didn't see the symptoms in my son having cancer. I didn't see the symptoms in my brother with a twin brother with acute cardiac event. I felt guilty about all of that, you know, and I think I learned to feel compassion for myself. You're human. We're all human. I'm a nurse. I felt like I should have seen it, you know, but we're human and we need to give ourselves a break. And it was writing about it and processing that, that let me let it go. I think a lot of people say, just let the guilt go. Well, it doesn't happen like that. You have to spend time with it and process it and work through it. Those emotions don't just disappear. You face them and then you let them go.
Right. And I think that's so important for you to highlight that you can't just say you're going to get over an emotion there. It's a process. It's a journey and it's different for everybody. And I think those are some wonderful points you talked about trying to reach that balance. And of course, it's going to be a little bit different for everyone, and helping other people achieve that balance can be challenging. And so that kind of leads me into my next question, which is, how did becoming a caregiver change the way you viewed oncology care?
Well, I think probably the most important thing is it was pediatrics and not adult. And so I was launched into a whole new world that I knew a little bit about, but not a lot. And so I think what I learned is pediatrics is family-centered care. And adult oncology, we address the family, we acknowledge the family, we try to include the family, but we treat the patient. And so the most important thing I learned as a caregiver in pediatrics is how different the worlds are, but also how really it's not about all that as much as it is being there and being present for your person you're caregiving for and being able to ask for help. I think that you can't carry it all yourself. You need to be okay with asking for help and knowing your limits and taking breaks.
Right. Yeah, that's an excellent point. And to switch gears a little bit, to go back to when you were talking about your research, and you talked about you were interested in how the mind and the body work together, particularly in patients with cancer. Could you talk a little bit about your research? And I know you mentioned in your book that you've given a bunch of talks, including one at the ONS Congress. So I'd love to hear a little bit about what you were working on and how Brennan's diagnosis changed your view of your research.
Well, how it changed my view of research is I launched into pediatrics.
Right.
You know, and I did both. I did both pediatric and oncology research. But the bottom theme, I guess, you know, was intervention research. I wanted to make a difference with my patients and families. And so I continued. I just transferred or added on really pediatric research in mind-body medicine and integrative health So I was doing two studies when Brennan was diagnosed, both of them being with women with breast cancer, and testing the effects of mental imagery, mindfulness, meditation on immune outcomes. So originally I wanted to know, how do people's, you know, I wanted to know the positive. There's so much negative in our world, and how about, you know, the big C and the big cancer, but I wanted to know, what is it that people have that get them through? How does the mind interact with the body? How does the body signal the mind? And there's a lot of, you know, research since then on neuroendocrinology and the cytokines. And, you know, I studied beta endorphins and natural killer cells and T lymphocytes and cortisol responses. But I wanted to know, is there a physiologic reason? But also really, what's the emotional response when you have something like cancer? And can we make a difference by empowering patients and families? So that's what I was doing at the time. But I also did a study on hope. And I keep coming back to this because it was innovative for me. It was qualitative research. And it was talking to patients and families. They were adult patients. So we're 32 patients that we followed over 18 months. We interviewed them 4 times. And we wanted to know, what gives them hope? And does it hope change over time, you know, regardless of what their prognosis is or their diagnosis is? And several things surprised me. One of them surprised me. The themes that came out of it were people found, you know, have been repeated over time in other studies. You know, we find hope by our internal resources and our inner strengths, but also our external, our relationships, and our empowering relationships that make us feel valued and cared for, and our spiritual and religious background. And I think one of the things surprised me that people would say, I'm not religious, but they talked about their connectedness with the universe, their connectedness with others. They had a strong spiritual connection. And that came through. And living in the moment, you know, these are the same things that I think, you know, I was looking back at the study thinking, these are the same things that I talk about in my book. And it's very much living in the moment and be present. But the one that surprised me the most was that patients and families emphasized survival. They needed to know that they had a chance at surviving. And my colleague, a nursing colleague, was diagnosed with breast cancer and was end stage disease right when my son was diagnosed. And I asked her, and I said, or she asked me, what's the prognosis? And then she told me, you know, and at that point, it was 85% survival with kids with ALL. My son had an excellent prognosis. We just had to get through 3 years of treatment. And I asked Karen her perspective, and she had end-stage breast cancer. And she said, well, I had 10% chance for survival, but I believed I was going to be in that 10%. And it was after my son was diagnosed that I realized how important it is to believe that you will survive, that you have that chance to survive. And so that's one thing that I've carried with me all the way through.
Love that. Could you speak for a moment about those pictures that Brennan drew? Because that is such a big focus throughout the book, and how he processed those emotions, and what a almost profound way for a four-year-old to connect with what he's feeling and to put those thoughts down and on into pictures.
You know, and it actually is interesting because he was 4 years old, and he the first day in the hospital, he asked for paper and pencil, or he asked for colors and paper. And I asked the child life specialist. And so she brought some toy that you like spin, and, you know, no, he wanted to create. So, you know, I had somebody bring in paper and crayons, and that's what he did that entire first year. He did a little bit after that, but those are the ones that I included in there. The two that are the most striking to me that are in the book are the first day in the hospital when he drew a house, and he drew a house with a tiny, he told me it's a little bird stuck in a house. There's no windows or doors. And he didn't want anybody to come in. He didn't say I'm that little yellow bird, but it was clear that he was. And then 2 days later, it was right after Christmas time, and he added toys and lights. And he said, I wanted it to look pretty for you, Mom. You know, and so that was his way. And I didn't re-look at those pictures until I went to sit down and write this talk for the Meyer lecture. And then it just like, wow, this is what he's been through. And the interesting thing about that is this is Brennan at 4.5 years old and 5 years old. He's now 29, and he's a thinker, a processor, a knowledge person, you know, what does he do with his emotions? He shoves them under the rug like we've all been trained to do, you know? But he's the one who said, we did a book signing at a local indie bookstore, and he's the one, he came up, he flew up and participated. And he said, you know, what I learned from reading the book is it's really not about knowledge alone. It's also about honoring your emotions. So I think that, you know, maybe reflecting back and reading on his own journey. I mean, he drew pictures of an angry day, and it was clearly he was angry. He drew a family picture for preschool at 4 and a half, right when he went back to preschool, and his little brother Tyler was like a little faint yellow being in the picture. And I'm like, I wrote Tyler's name on it because it's like, no, he's there. Your brother is there. He's part of the family. So it, you know, it was such a powerful reflection on what he had been through. And I wished I knew how to draw and done the same, but I wrote. Some people draw, some people talk. I wrote in a journal, and that's how I processed.
Very important. So I feel like throughout this whole call, you make it seem that writing the book was a very therapeutic process. But what essentially motivated you to put pen to proverbial paper and write the book?
That's a really good question. You know, I planned to write the book when I took a sabbatical over 11 weeks in one book. That didn't happen. It took me 10 years, you know, but it took me 4 years to write it. And the stimulus was I started to dream that Brennan had died. He was 10 years off treatment. He was a survivor. And I had dreams that of his death. And I'm like, something's buried here and something's trying to come out and I need to face it. And we dropped him off at college 500 miles away. And I said, now is the time. And I took classes. But it was really that realization that I have to deal with this. I've buried these feelings for all these years. And if I'm going to release them, I have to address them. And keeping stuff inside traps us emotionally, you know, and it affects our well-being. It affects our own health. And until we address it. So that's why I wrote the book. And that's what stimulated me to write it at the time that I started writing. And I took classes and I just dove in and went as deep as I could and processed it. And, you know, it feels a whole lot better coming out on the other side. Whether you write a book or a journal or a letter to someone, it feels better afterward.
So you kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier in our phone call, but I noticed that the book you wrote, after a day of seeking answers and direction, I was concerned by confusion. Why did I allow his symptoms to drag on for so long? How did you eventually overcome that somewhat guilt of being a nurse and kind of not seeing what was in front of you at the moment until a doctor diagnosed him with leukemia?
Yeah, well, I was up all night trying to figure out why the heck. And the doctor had said, well, 2 months is the norm. Yeah, okay, it was 2 months. Why? Why did it take me so long? You know, I think it's like, and then you reflect back, you know, on, you know, how did I miss that? Well, of course it makes sense. I mean, looking back does. We can ruminate and we can anticipate and we ruminate about the past. We worry about the future, but the important thing is to stay present in the day. Guilt is an incredible burden, you know, and all those woulda, shoulda, couldas, shoulda, woulda, couldas, you know, whatever, you know, you think about is I should have done that. Why didn't I see that? It's a burden to carry. And I think it's important most importantly is to acknowledge it and say, hey, I feel guilty about this. I need to process this before I can let it go. And I think writing helped me do that, but that's what you need to do. You need to process it and you need to feel it again before you can let it go. It's not worth carrying the rest of your life. And I know people do.
Me included.
We're human. We all do.
Indeed. And then also I noticed you have a chapter in your book called Finding Normal. So how did you and your son, yourself, your whole family unit find that normal again?
Well, as we know with COVID and the pandemic, you never go back to what the normal was before. Sure. And we never go back to the normal before cancer. You know, so it was, you know, we talk about a new normal and some people today say, well, there is no new normal. It doesn't feel normal at all. But I see it as normal and as an illusion of our expectations. It's what we expect. We want it to be normal and it's never going to be normal again. So we just redefine normal. So for me, it was a mindset change. And in that chapter, I talk about the summer in between his two delayed intensification treatments. We had 8 weeks of interim maintenance, which he's still on treatment. He still ended up in the emergency room and had events, but it was a less aggressive phase of treatment. And I was faculty, so I had more flexibility to be home in the summer. And so I just set the mindset that we are going to play. I'm going to reconnect with my kids and I'm going to let those expectations go. Whatever happens, happens. And we knew things would happen and we learned to expect the unexpected and accept the uncertainty. That's the new normal, you know? And what I learned to do is on my calendar, when I had student meetings, I would always write down their phone number then. I would just put them because if I had an event, Brennan would get sick. I had to be somewhere. I had to cancel a talk because he ended up in the hospital that day, you know, and the cancer center is like, well, that's okay. You know, we'll just cancel it. I'm like, oh, that was easy enough. You know, so I just learned you do what you need to do in the moment and that's your new normal and you make it what it was. And I think that was an empowering moment. That was an empowering summer for me because then what I realized is we are a family who has cancer, we are undergoing treatment, but that doesn't define us. How we live with cancer is up to us. You know, we really can make those decisions and have that power, but we have to remain flexible and open and adaptable, just like we do today.
Fair enough. So what advice would you give families and loved ones who are currently taking on the role of a caregiver for a patient with cancer, especially if it's a younger child with cancer? What advice would you give them?
Well, we give a lot of advice and we give a lot of advice. Right. And you know what? Do your patients and families listen to your advice?
I would hope they do.
You would hope they do. I think the best advice comes from within, comes from you, comes from them. So I think my advice is listen to yourself. Trust yourself. Know that you know yourself, you know your family, you know your child, and listen to that. But I think the important thing is if you are a person who doesn't tend to reflect or think through things or process things, and we get so busy doing things in our life, I think we need to honor that time and sit back and take that time. You know, it doesn't have to be formal meditation, but it needs to be, how was my day? What am I grateful for? What would I have done differently? How could I have done this better? Because that's what teaches us. And then we give ourselves advice and that's how we learn to be who we become to be and become better people in our eyes. And that's who we want to be. So, and I think the other thing is read, you know, read about other families, you know, here, read about standing at water's edge. I think it's, you know, we learn from others, you know, and it's the stories that matter. Why did we go into nursing? I went into nursing because I wanted to feel connected and I wanted to make a difference. But it's what I learned from families who do survive and survive, not just physically, but emotionally and get through. What are their strengths? I learned from other people's strengths and I think they inspire us. And, you know, resilient families have strength and they have courage and they have hope. And if they can do it, you can do it. So, you know, we read memoir to see ourselves reflected in other people's experiences. And what we, even if we take away one or two things from that, it's important because then we get inspired to be better and to see things differently. And so read, listen, reflect, think, but listen to yourself and be present. Be present to yourself as well as to your family members.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cancer Horizons podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cancer Horizons podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine or Facebook at @curemagazine.